The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is, and it's a Thursday, so that's good news because, you know, one more day and then the weekend. So we got that going for us. And Joe Biden today signed the American Relief Plan Act into law. Now, he wasn't going to sign it until tomorrow. So this was kind of a surprise. He brought everyone into the Oval Office and they did a thing. In fact, here, because I can, let me share that with you. Here's how it went. Okay, Joe, go ahead.
The weeks that this bill has been discussed and debated, it's clear that an overwhelming percentage of the American people, Democrats, independents, or Republican friends, have made it clear, the people out there, made it clear they strongly support the American Rescue Plan. Yesterday, passage of the plan in the House of Representatives, their voices were heard and reflected in everything we have in this bill. And I believe this is, and most people I think do as well, this historic legislation is about rebuilding the backbone of this country and giving people in this nation, working people, middle-class folks, people who built the country, a fighting chance. That's what the essence of it is. And I'm going to have a lot more to say about that tonight in the next couple of days and be able to take your questions. But in the meantime, what I'm going to do is sign this bill.
Cool.
And make the presentation tonight, and then there's going to be plenty of opportunities. We're going to be on the road, not only talking about what I'm talking about tonight is the impact on the virus and how we're going to end this pandemic.
Okay.
We're going to talk all the elements of the bill, beginning Friday, Saturday, and through the week.
Yeah, because he's going on a PR blitz. All right, and now he is signing the bill. Woohoo! All right. It's got not really exciting, but, you know, guess what? He didn't scribble his name. He also, you know, didn't take any questions. So he and Kamala Harris left the Oval Office. They went into the next room. And hopefully he'll have his big press conference sometime soon. And then tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, Joe Biden will speak to the nation. You know, it was this is so weird. It was 1 year ago tonight that Donald Trump addressed the nation from the Oval Office because, well, that was the day that this became a reality, that the coronavirus, that COVID-19 was hitting us and hitting us hard, despite what the idiot said and the way he lied. If you had listened to Dr. Fauci, as, you know, hopefully you did, this is what Dr. Fauci said on March 11th of last year.
Is the worst yet to come, Dr. Fauci?
Yes, it is. We will see more cases and things will get worse than they are right now. How much worse we'll get will depend on our ability to do two things: to contain the influx of people who are infected coming from the outside, and the ability to contain and mitigate within our own country. Bottom line, it's going to get worse.
Thank you, Dr. Fauci. See, Dr. Fauci was honest with us from the beginning. And Trump, what did he do? So from the Oval Office, and I'm not going to assault your ears. Look, we've had more than enough of him to last a lifetime. But here's a little 6-second clip from his Oval Office address to the nation.
This is the most aggressive and comprehensive effort to confront a foreign virus in modern history.
A foreign virus. The fucking moron can't help himself. You know what? Maybe that's a bit harsh of me. I've got a sort of an apology for my Trump loving friends, but I don't have any Trump loving friends. If you love Donald Trump, you're not my friend. Seriously, we have different values. But more on that in a moment. Let me just tell you some other things that happened. So Biden signed the American Rescue Plan today into law. Tonight, he addresses the nation about it. And then this weekend, he takes off to travel the country to explain to Americans what's exactly in it, how it's going to help them. I mean, we've all heard, all right, we're going to get the $1,400 checks, which are not $2,000. But again, you can't put that on him. You know, he is working with a hostile half of a Congress. And so it Marco, welcome to the welcome to the show. Marco's new today in the YouTube chat, and he just wrote, "Nicole sounds so sweet." I wouldn't describe me as sweet, and you'll understand as the hour goes on, Marco. But thank you. First impressions are often wrong. I'm a good person. I can be nice, but sweet? I don't know. Anyway, we told you a lot yesterday about what's in this bill. Excuse me. Here's another short explainer from CNN, because this is really good. And while, excuse me, while, because it's only an audio clip. So for those of you who are watching one of the video feeds, while we listen to CNN, I'll give you a little video tour of what's behind me, because I rearranged the gallery of my paintings behind me. So we'll shoot two birds and get stoned. All right, here we go.
It's huge, historic. Families can expect thousands of dollars in relief. First, those stimulus checks, up to $1,400 for about 90% of households. The full amount for individuals making up to $75,000 a year and phasing out at $80,000. A check for each kid, and this time, their adult dependents qualify. Think an elderly parent and college-age student. If history is a guide, once signed into law, it could take a matter of days to start to hit bank accounts. People with bank information on file with the IRS, they're likely to get their money first based on their most recent tax return. That's 2019 if you haven't filed for 2020 yet. But the bigger payout here is the expanded child tax credit, a critical and historic effort to eradicate income inequality and child poverty. It gives parents with children six and under $3,600 per child for a year, and $3,000 per child age 7 through 17, $500 for each child 17 and 18, or full-time college students 19 to 24. Key here, direct monthly payments instead of getting a lump sum at tax time. Some back-of-the-envelope math, a family with two parents, two kids making, say, $96,000 a year, added up, that's $1,400 stimulus checks four times, $3,000 for each child under 18, that's $11,600 for that family. Another example, a single mother with one child. A stimulus check and the child tax credit together equal $5,800. And there's a more generous earned income tax credit. So much of this legislation is geared toward low-income Americans. The Tax Policy Center says a low-income household with children would get an average tax cut of nearly $7,700, raising their after-tax income by more than 35%. This law is sprawling. Yes. There are tax breaks for child care and dependent seniors or an incapacitated spouse, subsidies for health care premiums, money for agriculture, including $5 billion for disadvantaged farmers, a quarter of whom are black. There's housing aid, incentives for paid sick leave, plussed up food stamp benefits through September, money for vaccine distribution and for schools, and an extra $300 a week in jobless benefits through the fall. And the first $10,200 is tax-free for eligible households.
So there's a bit of what's in it. And again, it is a massive bill. So as the days and months progress, we'll learn more of what's in it. Yesterday, I told you a lot about another part of it, which is the health insurance, help with health insurance. First of all, the exchanges are open again if you happen to have lost your job and with it your insurance. And you know how the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act was only, you know, Trump cut it to 6 weeks at the end of the year. And if you miss that time, you're out of luck. And Biden just opened up like a 3 month long and special enrollment period so you can still get in. And the American Rescue Act, Rescue Plan, ARP, I'm going to have to remember that. ARP. ARP is going to make it less painful for you, more affordable, go figure. So I don't know the specifics yet. Frankly, I'm hoping it lowers my premiums a little bit. It should. That's what the money is there for. It's there to help Americans who are hurting, and so many of us are. So, all right. I got to share this with you. It's Thursday, so just so you know, Howie Klein will be here. And today, he's going to introduce us to the newest candidate endorsed by his Blue America PAC. And that is Erica Smith. And Erica, you know, you heard that Richard Burr is retiring from the Senate, Senator, Democratic Senator from North Carolina. Well, Erica Smith is running for that seat, and you will meet her today on the show. She'll join Howie and me in the last half hour, so you'll get to meet her. If people who are asking about the paintings behind me, email me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. I'm very reasonable. Yes, all my paintings are for sale. Actually, they're not for sale. They're for a donation to the pro. What?
Burr's a Republican.
Burr. No. Oh, no. Oh, Burr is a Republican. You're right. Thank you. I had a brain fart there. Burr is a Republican. Duh. He was the Republican I'm still having COVID flaky head effects from the vaccine, I think. Or I'll just blame it on that. It's just my general spaciness. You're right. Burr is a Republican who's retiring. Sorry. We have a chance to pick up that seat. So you'll meet Erica Smith. Regarding the paintings, most of them are posted at NicoleSandler.com/pandemic-painting. For those of you who are listening and want to see what I just showed everyone on the video. And if you're interested in any of them for donation to the show, I will give you one of my originals. So email me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. Okay, so we have Howie and Erica coming up. I saw something this morning on Facebook, of all places, and I was blown away by how just I could have written this if I had the time and patience to do so. So I'm going to share it with you. And it's sort of an apology to Trump-supporting friends. But as I already said, I don't have any of those. So to anyone out there, you know, who thinks I've been a bit harsh, well, let me share this with you. It goes on for a while, so get comfortable. All right, you ready? And I have no idea who wrote this. At the bottom of this long post, it just said, I wish I had come up with this. I don't know. Just share it. So whoever wrote this, thank you. And the other thing is, keep track. If you come up with some that are left off this list, I want to keep adding to it because we need to never forget. I know, you know, out of sight, out of mind, it's easy to forget how heinous the guy was. But we lived through it for 4 years, and the post-traumatic stress is still with many of us. So with that said, here we go. It says, I owe my Trump-supporting friends an apology. I've been critical of the Trump presidency these last 4 years, and I'm still exhausted from the experience. But to be fair, Trump wasn't that bad, other than when he incited an insurrection against the government, mismanaged a pandemic that killed nearly 500,000 Americans, or actually this must have been written before, that killed over 500,000 Americans, I guess I have to edit it as I go along, separated children from families and lost those children in the bureaucracy, tear-gassed peaceful protesters on Lafayette Square so he could hold a photo op holding a Bible upside down in front of a church, tried to block all Muslims from entering the country, got impeached again, had the worst jobs record of any president in modern history, pressured Ukraine to dig dirt on Joe Biden, fired the FBI director for investigating his ties to Russia, bragged about firing the FBI director on TV, took Vladimir Putin's word over the U.S. intelligence community, diverted military funding to build his wall, caused the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, called Black Lives Matter a, quote, symbol of hate, lied around 30,000 times, banned transgender people from serving in the military, ejected reporters from the White House briefing room who asked tough questions, vetoed the defense funding bill because it renamed military bases named for Confederate soldiers, refused to release his tax returns, and lied about the reason that he refused to release the tax returns, increased the national debt by nearly $8 trillion, had three of the highest annual trade deficits in U.S. history, called veterans and soldiers who died in combat losers and suckers, coddled the crown prince of Saudi Arabia after he ordered the execution and dismembering of a U.S.-based journalist, refused to concede the 2020 election after he lost decidedly, hired his unqualified daughter and son-in-law to work in the White House, walked out on an interview with Leslie Stahl, called neo-Nazis, quote, very fine people, suggested that people should inject bleach into their bodies to fight COVID, abandoned our allies, the Kurds, to Turkey, pushed through massive tax cuts for the wealthiest but balked at helping working Americans, incited anti-lockdown protesters in several states at the height of the pandemic, withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords, withdrew from the U.S. From the Iranian nuclear deal, insulted his own cabinet members on Twitter, pushed the leader of Montenegro out of the way during a photo op, remember that? Failed to reiterate U.S. commitment to defending NATO allies. He called Haiti and African nations shithole countries. Called the city of Baltimore the, quote, worst in the nation. He claimed that he single-handedly brought back the phrase Merry Christmas, even though it hadn't gone anywhere. He forced his cabinet members to praise him publicly like some cult leader. Come on, you remember those cabinet meetings where they'd go around the table, right? He believed he should be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and he badmouthed 16-year-old Greta Thunberg when she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He berated and belittled his hand-picked attorney general when he rightfully recused himself from the Russia probe, suggested the United States should buy Greenland. He colluded with Mitch McConnell to push through federal judges and two Supreme Court justices after supporting efforts to prevent his predecessor from appointing any judges. He repeatedly called the media, quote, enemies of the people. He claimed that if we tested fewer people for COVID, we'd have fewer cases. Oh, yeah. Violated the emoluments clause. Thought Nambia was a country. Told Bob Woodward in private that the coronavirus was a big deal, but then downplayed it in public because he didn't want to, what did he say? He didn't want to panic people. Ay. He called his exceedingly faithful vice president a, quote, pussy for following the Constitution. Nearly got us into a war with Iran after threatening them by tweet. Nominated a corrupt head of the EPA. Nominated a corrupt head of Health and Human Services. Nominated a corrupt head of the Interior Department. Nominated a corrupt head of the USDA. He praised dictators and authoritarians around the world while criticizing allies. He refused to allow the presidential transition to begin. He insulted war hero John McCain even after his death. He spent an obscene amount of time playing golf after criticizing Barack Obama for playing a lot less golf while president. He falsely claimed that he won the 2016 popular vote. He called the Muslim mayor of London a, quote, stone-cold loser. He falsely claimed that he turned down being Time's Man of the Year, and yet he still doesn't understand that Time's Person of the Year is not an honor. He considered firing special counsel Robert Mueller on several occasions. He mocked wearing face masks to guard against transmitting COVID. He locked Congress out of its constitutional duty to confirm cabinet officials by naming acting ones. He used a racist dog whistle by calling COVID the China virus. He hired and associated with numerous shady figures that were eventually convicted of federal offenses, including his own campaign manager and national security advisor. He pardoned several of his shady associates. He gave the goddamn Presidential Medal of Freedom to two congressmen who amplified his batshit crazy conspiracy theories. Got into a telephone fight with the leader of Australia right after taking office. Remember that? It was his first call with a foreign leader, and he insulted them. him. He had a Secretary of State who called him a moron, actually called him a fucking moron. He forced his press secretary to claim without merit that his was the largest inauguration crowd in history. He botched the COVID vaccine rollout. He tweeted so much dangerous propaganda that Twitter eventually banned him. He charged the Secret Service jacked up rates at his properties. Actually, we paid for them. Constantly interrupted Joe Biden in their presidential debate, actually the first one and others, claimed that COVID would magically disappear, called a U.S. Senator Pocahontas, used his Twitter account to blast Nordstrom when it stopped selling Ivanka's merchandise. He opened up millions of pristine federal lands to development, got into a losing tariff war with China that forced U.S. taxpayers to bail out farmers, then claimed that his losing tariff war was a win for the U.S. He ignored or didn't even take part in daily intelligence briefings, blew off honoring American war dead in France because it was raining. It might mess up his hair. He got played by Kim Jong-un in his love letters, threatened to go after social media companies in clear violation of the Constitution. He botched the response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico and then threw paper towels at Puerto Ricans when he finally visited them. Pressured the governor and secretary of state of Georgia to, quote, find him the votes. He thought that the Virgin Islands had a president. He drew on a map with a Sharpie to justify his inaccurate tweet that Alabama was threatened by a hurricane. He allowed White House staff to use personal email accounts for official business after blasting Hillary Clinton for doing the same thing. Rolled back regulations that protected the public from mercury and asbestos. Then pushed regulators to waste time studying snake oil remedies for COVID. Hydroxychloroquine, anyone? He rolled back regulations that stopped coal companies from dumping waste into rivers, held blatant campaign rallies at the White House, tried to take away millions of Americans' health insurance because the law was named for and or passed by a black man, refused to attend his successor's inauguration, nominated the worst education secretary in history, threatened judges who didn't do what he wanted, attacked Dr. Anthony Fauci, promised that Mexico would pay for his stupid wall. They didn't. Allowed political hacks to overrule government scientists on major reports on climate change and other issues. He struggled navigating a ramp after claiming his opponent was feeble. Called an African-American congresswoman low IQ. Threatened to withhold federal aid from states and cities with Democratic leaders. Went ahead with rallies filled with maskless supporters in the middle of a pandemic. Claimed that legitimate investigations of his wrongdoing were, quote, witch hunts. Seemed to demonstrate a belief that there were airports during the American Revolution. He did. Demanded total loyalty from the FBI director. Praised a conspiracy theory that Democrats are satanic pedophiles. He completely gutted the Voice of America, placed a political hack in charge of the U.S. Postal Service, claimed without evidence that the Obama administration bugged Trump Tower, suggested that the U.S. should allow more people from places like Norway into the country, suggested that COVID wasn't that bad because he recovered with the help of top government doctors and treatments not available to the general public. He overturned energy conservation standards that even the industry supported. He reduced the number of refugees the U.S. will accept, insulted various members of Congress and the media with infantile nicknames, gave hate monger Rush Limbaugh a Presidential Medal of Freedom at the State of the Union address. He named as head of federal personnel a 29-year-old who'd previously been fired from the White House for allegations of financial improprieties. He eliminated the White House Office of Pandemic Response. He used soldiers as campaign props. He fired any advisor who made the mistake of disagreeing with him. He demanded the Pentagon throw him a Soviet-style military parade. He hired a shit ton of white nationalists, politicized the civil service, did absolutely nothing after Russia hacked the U.S. government, falsely said the Boy Scouts called him to say that his bizarre jamboree speech was the best speech ever given to the Scouts. No. He claimed that black people would overrun the suburbs if Biden won. insulted reporters of color, insulted women reporters, insulted women reporters of color, suggested he was fine with China's oppression of the Uyghurs. He attacked the Supreme Court when it ruled against him. He summoned Pennsylvania state legislative leaders to the White House to pressure them to overturn the election. Spent countless hours every day watching Fox News, refused to allow his administration to comply with congressional subpoenas. He hired goddamn Rudy Giuliani as his lawyer. He tried to punish Amazon because the Jeff Bezos-owned Washington Post wrote negative stories about him. He acted as if the Attorney General of the United States was his personal attorney. He attempted to get the federal government to defend him in a libel lawsuit from a woman who accused him of rape. He held private meetings with Vladimir Putin without staff present, didn't disclose his private meetings with Putin so that the U.S. had to find out through Russian media. He stopped holding press briefings for months at a time, ordered U.S. companies to leave China, even though he has no such power. He led a political party that couldn't even be bothered to draft a policy platform for 2020. Seriously, they used the 2016 platform. He claimed preposterously that Article 1 of the Constitution gave him absolute powers, tried to pressure the UK to hold the British Open at his golf course. He suggested that the government nuke hurricanes, that wind turbines cause cancer, and that he had a special aptitude for science because he has a relative who went to MIT. He fired the head of election cybersecurity for saying that the 2020 election was secure. He blurted out classified information to Russian officials, tried to force the G7 to hold their meeting at his failing golf resort in Florida. He fired the acting attorney general when she refused to go along with his unconstitutional Muslim ban. He hired Stephen Miller, for God's sakes, openly discussed national security issues in the dining room at Mar-a-Lago where everyone could hear them. He interfered with plans to relocate the FBI because a new development there might compete with his hotel. He abandoned Iraqi refugees who'd helped the U.S. during the war, tried to get Russia back into the G7, held a COVID super spreader event in the Rose Garden, seemed to believe that Frederick Douglass is still alive. He hears he's doing fabulous things. He lost 60 election fraud cases in court, including before judges that he himself had nominated. He falsely claimed that factories were reopening when they weren't, shamelessly exploited terror attacks in Europe to justify his anti-immigrant policies. He still hasn't come up with a health care plan, even though he kept promising, oh, within 2 weeks, you'll have it on your desk. It'll be passed. Still hasn't come up with an infrastructure plan, despite repeated infrastructure weeks. He forced Secret Service agents to drive him around Walter Reed while contagious with COVID. He told the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by, and he fucked up the census, withdrew the U.S. from the World Health Organization in the middle of a pandemic, did so few of his duties that his press staff were forced to state on his daily schedule, quote, President Trump will work from early in the morning until late in the evening. He will make many calls and have many meetings. True. All this is true. He allowed his staff to repeatedly violate the Hatch Act. Seemed not to know that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, stood before the sacred CIA wall of heroes and bragged about his election win, constantly claimed he was treated worse than any president, which presumably includes four that were assassinated, and his predecessor, whose legitimacy and birthplace were challenged by a racist reality TV show star named Donald Trump. He claimed Andrew Jackson could have stopped the Civil War, even though he died 16 years before it happened. He said that any opinion poll showing him behind was fake, claimed that other countries laughed at us before he became president when several world leaders were literally laughing at him while he was, claimed that the military was out of ammunition before he became president. He created a commission to whitewash American history. He retweeted anti-Islam videos from one of the most racist people in Britain and then claimed ludicrously that the Pulse nightclub shooting wouldn't have happened if just someone there had a gun, even though there was an armed security guard. And now I'm looking at the clock and I am, well, you know what? We're going to keep going because I'm almost there. We'll be a minute or two late for Howie. He hired a staffer who cited the non-existent Bowling Green massacre as a reason to ban Muslims, had a press secretary who claimed that Nazi Germany never used chemical weapons, even though every sane human being knows they used gas to kill millions of Jews and others. He bilked the Secret Service for higher than market rates when they had to stay at Trump properties, apparently sold pardons on his way out of the White House, stripped protective status from 59,000 Haitians, falsely claimed that Joe Biden wanted to defund the police, said that the head of the CDC didn't know what he was talking about, tried to rescind protections from Dreamers, gave himself an A+ for his handling of the pandemic, tried to start a boycott of Goodyear tires due to an internet hoax, said U.S. rates of COVID would be lower if you didn't count the blue states, deported U.S. veterans who served their country but were undocumented, claimed he did more for African Americans than any president since Lincoln, and then later even said, even including Lincoln. He touted a super-duper secret hydrosonic missile, which may or may not be the new hypersonic missile or may not exist at all. He retweeted a GIF calling Biden a pedophile, forced through security clearances for his family, suggested that police officers should rough up suspects, suggested that Joe Biden was on performance-enhancing drugs. He tried to stop transgendered students from being able to use school bathrooms in line with their gender, suggested that the U.S. not accept COVID patients from a cruise ship at the start of this a year ago because it would make the U.S. numbers look higher. He nominated a climate change skeptic to chair the committee advising the White House on environmental policy, retweeted a video doctored to look like Biden had played a song called Fuck the Police at a campaign event. He hugged a disturbingly large number of U.S. flags, accused Democrats of treason for not applauding his State of the Union address. He claimed that the FBI failed to capture the Parkland school shooter because they were, quote, spending too much time on Russia. He mocked the testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford when she accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. He obsessed over low-flow toilets. He ordered the re-release of more COVID vaccines when there weren't any to release. He called for the construction of a bizarre garden of heroes with statues of famous dead Americans, as well as at least one Canadian, that being Alex Trebek. Hijacked Washington's July 4th celebrations to give a partisan speech, took advice from the MyPillow guy, claimed that migrants seeking a better life in the U.S. were dangerous caravans of drug dealers and rapists, said nothing when Putin poisoned a leading opposition figure, never seemed to heed the advice of his wife's Be Best campaign, falsely claimed that mail-in voting is fraudulent, announced a precipitous withdrawal of troops from Syria, which not only handed Russia and ISIS a win, but also prompted his defense secretary to resign in protest. He insulted the leader of Canada, of France, of Britain, of Germany, of Sweden, and falsely claimed credit for getting NATO members to increase their share of dues. He blew off two Asia summits, even though they were held virtually. He continued lying about spending lots of time at Ground Zero with 9/11 responders. He said that the Japanese would sit back and watch their Sony televisions if the U.S. were ever attacked. He left a NATO summit early in a huff. He stared directly into an eclipse, even though everyone over the age of 5 knows not to do that. He called himself a very stable genius, despite significant evidence to the contrary. He refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power and kept his promise. And a whole bunch of other things that I can't remember at the moment. But feel free to add in. See, but other than that, he's been great. He's just been fucking great. And there you have it. Again, I read that in bits and pieces throughout the day on Facebook because it was so long. And all I could say is, whoever wrote that is a genius. And I think I will publish it. I will post the whole thing on my blog today at NicoleSandler.com. /3-11-21. And I suggest we keep a running list. Anything we left out, let me know. I'll add it on. After that, I don't know about you, but I need a Dirty Debbie.
Are you a multinational corporation hungry for a treat? Well, come on down to Schmucky Chucky's, where you'll personally be seated by Chuck Schumer himself.
So many dishes, and they're all fresh.
You're going to love our Blue Dog special, the Dino Burger, because we say so.
A good hamburger and french fries.
And every burger comes with a side order of
grits. I love grits. I love anything with corn. It's corn.
All for only $50,000. $1,000. Wash it all down with a Dirty Debbie.
9/10 water, 1/10 oranges. After a week or two, you drink this, it's 200 calories and it's acetic.
And wipe your mouth with a tissue print of Glass-Steagall. For dessert, try our DNC tarts.
Little cookies, tell the quality of that.
Most restaurants give you a mint, but at Schmucky Chucky's, you get complimentary.
Sweet and low.
Who picks up the tab for all this? Find out now with Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com on the Nicole Sandler Show.
Hey, Howie Klein.
Hello, Nicole Sandler.
How are you doing?
Doing great.
Good.
How about you?
I'm hanging in there. It's a Thursday. Joe Biden signed the big bill, the American Rescue Plan Act. I keep having to remember how ARP. I have to remember that. But I think it's good.
Anti-minimum wage increase bill.
Okay, so they didn't get that through. I think they will still try. Again, you're dealing with a Republican
party.
No,
you got to understand.
Yeah?
There's no other way to get that through. It only can go through if it's not subject to a
filibuster.
What is it called?
Filibuster.
A filibuster. So
right.
That's the reason it was in this bill, so that it couldn't be filibustered by the Republicans. By taking it out of this bill, they just threw it in the garbage.
Yeah.
So Biden may say, oh, they'll try something else, but... No, don't fall for that.
All right. Well, I still think that there are people like Bernie Sanders.
Unhappiness for all the good stuff that's in the bill.
It does what to the happiness for all the good stuff?
I said you're drunk on the happiness of all the good stuff that's in the bill.
That's true.
Too. I mean,
yes.
It has a lot of wonderful stuff in it.
It really does, and I'm trying to be to be somewhat positive and optimistic because I just spent the last 20 minutes, Howie Klein, reading this post that I found on Facebook this morning that's sort of a backhanded apology to our, quote, Trump supporter friends for maybe being too harsh, and it goes on literally for 13 pages of things that Trump did, and it's far from a complete list, but it reminds us of even the little stupid shit. It was every goddamn day, and frankly, it's, you know, we can breathe again. So things aren't perfect, obviously, and they need to get better. And that brings us to the guest you're going to introduce us today to, right? Because we need a majority in the Senate, not a tie.
Yes. Well, not just a majority in the Senate, because we know having people like Joe Manchin in the Senate and having people like Kyrsten Sinema in the Senate, and there are several others. Those are just the two worst, but there are also, you know, the two from Delaware and the two from
New Hampshire
and the two from Virginia.
Yep.
I mean, we've got some pretty terrible senators. So what we're talking about now is someone who is running, a former state senator, Erica Smith, who is running for the U.S. Senate in North Carolina, and she is running on an unabashed progressive platform. And I think we're better off having Erica join us.
Yes.
if she's on the line.
Yes, she is.
Me talking,
right?
To her.
And
she
we
knows
will
more
for
about her than I know about
okay,
her.
Okay, but before I bring her in, Howie Klein, for those who don't know, because we always have a lot of new people joining the show. You, in addition to, of course, writing it down with tyranny.com, you, Digby, and John Amato run the Blue America PAC, and you find, you identify, recruit, and raise money for progressive candidates. So that's why you're always bringing on these new Blue America endorsees, and Erica is your latest, yes?
Yes, Erica is someone who we knew from last year when she was a state senator, and she wanted to run for the other North Carolina seat. But Chuck Schumer decided that they needed a white conservative man, because only a white conservative man was going to beat the Republican incumbent.
Oh, God.
As it turned out, he was completely wrong, and his white conservative man failed, and now we have a Republican in for 6 years, thanks to Chuck Schumer's mistake. And, you know, don't leave it, you know, don't wait to find out that Chuck Schumer again.
That Chuck is doing what again?
And he'll do the same thing again if he can get away with it.
Yeah.
I mean, he will again take one look at the policies, which are completely people-oriented policies and family-oriented policies. He'll look at the policies that Erica Smith is espousing, and he'll say, oh, God, how can I handle this? We already have Bernie Sanders. We already have Elizabeth Warren. We already have Jeff Merkley. You know, we see that, and we say, yes, we need more people like them. He sees that and says, oy vey.
Oy vey. Oy vey. Okay. Well, she's here, so let's bring in Erica Smith. And Erica, welcome to the show. It's so nice to meet you.
I am so glad to be here. Thank you for having me, Nicole. Hey, Howie, always good to connect with you.
Of course, and great as well to connect with you. Why don't we start, if Nicole doesn't mind, and you don't mind, by you telling us what's important. I didn't mention that you're also an ordained pastor. And why don't you start by, if you don't mind, telling the audience what your spiritual beliefs, how they intersect with your political beliefs. Because people hear a lot about, you know, evangelicals supporting Trump and being, just being just so firmly against Jesus's message. And, I gather that that's not the kind of pastor that you are.
Absolutely not. Now, I consider myself a part of the rise of the religious left. And so for too long, Democrats have ceded the high road, the religious road, to Republicans. And we have seen with the last two administrations, with President Trump, with all of this inappropriate behavior that are far from the teachings of Jesus. I come from a strong Judeo-Christian background perspective. I am an ordained clergywoman under the Missionary Baptist, General Baptist State Convention of North Carolina, which is the largest faith organization in our state. I also come from the perspective of social justice. That is the tenet, that's the foundation of my faith. And so people always get concerned when they hear politicians talk about their faith. My faith does not interfere with anyone else's religious freedom, but what my faith does, it informs me on how to advance policy for the least of these. And so in my faith, we don't support locking kids in a cage at the border. In my faith, we promote pro-life choices for the mother and for the unborn child. And so we definitely know that there is a movement, particularly in the South, of those of us who are faith-based, and we have a strong commitment to social justice and liberty and equality for all, which is central to the biblical teachings of Jesus.
How about when it comes to economic justice? I know that, you know, just reading your website, I see that a lot of your campaign is about economic equality. So how does that play into your faith beliefs?
Absolutely. From Genesis to Revelation, he created men and women equal, and we are equal in the sight of God. We should have equal pay for equal work. As a Black woman, I only earn 62 cents on the dollar of a white male, and that is unfair, particularly when I'm doing the same level of work or producing even more. We've got to have the dignity of work. We need to have a livable wage. The Bible teaches in the Old Covenant and the New Covenant that unjust weights are not right. They're not acceptable. And we can no longer continue to pay people on a different salary based on the color of their skin or on their anatomical differences.
Let me ask a question here, because I think it's important that the left not cede the people of faith to the Republicans. It's insane, especially you see how they've perverted it. The fact that evangelicals got behind Donald Trump, I find astounding, because talk about hypocrisy. But there are people like me who are non-religious. And, when I heard Joe Biden has reopened an office of faith in the, in the administration, I believe in the separation of church and state. I think churches should pay taxes. So I appreciate your devotion and obviously I think you're in it for the right reasons, unlike Trump, who takes advantage of these people. But I don't want to see too much of an emphasis on Christ and religion in our government.
And that is the distinction of rise of the religious left. Mm-hmm. It is an understanding that there is separation between church and state. Our United States Constitution guarantees that. And so we have that privilege of the First Amendment and the freedom from religion. Mm-hmm. And so in understanding how our faith informs us to become better politicians is not to promote a certain religion or an ideology, other than affording people the basic human rights of health care for all, universal broadband, a fair wage, mm-hmm. Respecting the dignity of work, because all of these are teachings in the covenant that Jews and Christians That's follow, right. that a servant is worthy of their hire, and we should have adequate pay for the work that we do, and we should have a country that works for all of us and not just the wealthy and the well-connected.
Absolutely. And I've said often, look, I'm an atheist Jew, but I'm more, quote, Christian than some of these people. I believe in treating others the way I want to be treated. I believe in taking care of those among us who are hurting. I mean, I believe in the teachings that are ascribed to Christ, but not in organized religion as it stands today, because frankly, they're hypocrites for the most part. Anyway, sorry, Howie. I had to butt in.
No, you make a good point, Nicole. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good that you brought that up, Nicole, because there's a definite difference between an established church
yep.
and bringing a church into government,
yes.
and someone who's bringing these teachings
yes.
that we can all get behind, which is a very, very different thing. I mean, you don't want, like, whether it's you don't want any religion as an organized religion telling candidates what to do. But that isn't what Erica is talking about. What she's talking about is getting inspiration
sure.
from universal teachings that are believed not just by Christians, but also by Jews and also by Muslims.
Of course.
This is why I'm excited about this component of Erica's campaign.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to go, I mean, there's no disconnect here. I'm thrilled. And yes, it's time for Democrats who are believers and people of religion to take that back. How the Republicans claim to be the party of morals. Reverend Dr. Barber talks about this all the time, and I'm a huge fan of his. I learned about him years ago. I saw him at Netroots Nation. I got to interview him a couple of times. He's my guy. Again, this minister, and I'm the atheist Jew, but that's what religion should be, not, you know, a money thing and not perpetuating the lies from a corrupt and horrific president. So. Anyway.
Right. Well, you can vote for Erica if you move to North Carolina.
Moral movement. Absolutely.
It's a moral movement that affirms the dignity and humanity of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So another place, Erica, where this people might not expect you to be is that you, I read recently that you lived on a road that's never been paved, a dirt road,
oh.
and you represented a district that was 100% rural. So we're not talking about someone who is an urban Democrat. We're talking about someone who is a rural Democrat. I don't know that Chuck Schumer is ever going to understand what that means, but can you explain a little bit why the people in North Carolina are going to be able to relate to that when it comes to going to vote?
A rural Southern Democrat. And so what we learned from Georgia is that Georgia organized the rural parts of its state. And that is why Georgia, who everyone had ceded as a red state until the day they died, were able to flip and turn blue in 2020. And then they saved the nation with the election of Senator Warnock and Senator Ossoff. And so what we know is that no other candidate in North Carolina in the U.S. Senate race is leveraged to win this but myself. And that is because I'm the only candidate, well, the first African-American woman, the first African-American to be elected in a 100% rural district. And the challenge with with that is that we have been leaving votes on the table. We're able to get the Democratic vote in the urban centers, in Raleigh, in Charlotte, in Greensboro, in Durham. But where we have not had the representation of strong Democrats is in the rural regions. North Carolina has 80 rural counties. And this is what earned me the distinction of one of the top five in the state in the General Assembly, ready to lead statewide. It's because I have been able to build that type of coalition with Black, white, and brown, with urban and rural, and with men and women from all walks of life to build the type of coalition that's going to make the new electorate, the new voters who are going to help us flip North Carolina blue.
Great. Erica Smith, I want to give the website so people can check it out while listening. It's ericaforus.com, ericaforus.com. Your Twitter handle is, is it Erica for USNC?
Yeah, Erica for USSEN.
USSEN. Oh, USSEN. Right. Got it. Okay. Go ahead, Howie.
Erica, what do you specifically offer rural voters?
What I offer rural voters is an understanding of how we have to promote economic development through first having the infrastructure in place. This pandemic has shown us just how disconnected the rural areas of this state are. We have to have broadband. Broadband can no longer be considered a luxury. It is a basic utility. Broadband is how students are able to participate in their educational opportunities and remote learning. Broadband is how we advance telemedicine for those who cannot get outside of their home. Broadband is life-saving. It's how you order your groceries, how you order your supplies. And so what I bring to the strength of this campaign is having done the policy work to close the rural and urban divide. Many of these rural counties have been in systemic poverty, and their economic status improved under my leadership because I know what it takes to reshape our formulas and, you know, change the criteria, re-engineer the criteria so it works better for those rural locations, promoting small business infrastructure, as we shared. And so that is part of my platform, but my platform can be summarized, and people always ask me, what are your top issues? My top issues are the top issues and the challenges that face working Americans, not only all across North Carolina, but all across this nation. We have to address income inequality. That's very important in closing the rural and urban divide, because by geographical location, you have a big change in the salaries. We also need to have a livable wage, which we talked about earlier, and then closing the wealth gap by having equal pay for equal work. Secondly, I am promoting environmental justice and addressing this climate crisis that we are in once and for all, and create millions of good paying jobs. And that has been the strength of what we offer in the rural parts of the state. And last but not least, it's Medicare for all. This pandemic has shown us just how broken our healthcare system is when we prioritize profits over people. And so it's time for us to put an end to a family going bankrupt just because somebody got sick. And as a Black woman in the South, I care about racial justice. That is the strength of our campaign. That's our platform. It's a platform for building a North Carolina that works for all of us, not just some of us.
Erica, let me ask you a kind of a weird question, but there's a very good chance that Trump's sister-in-law, Laura Trump, is going to run for this seat.
Right.
I don't know if she's going to, but I keep reading about it. Are you? Does that make you excited? Do you think that that's going to help Democrats and that's going to help your campaign specifically?
Well, that's just what we need, another Trump on the ballot. We certainly do not need another Trump, another person of privilege. And so we already have enough Congress people who have come from wealth and not hard work like I've come from hard work. And so understand the dynamic and the dignity of work. We don't need a Laura Trump who has not put in the work. She's only lived a life of privilege, and she does not understand North Carolina. She does not know North Carolina. She attended school in North Carolina, but she has not served in North Carolina. So we welcome anyone to the field, but we know hands down, we have more to offer North Carolinians than Laura Trump. I am the only candidate in this race who has lived in, worked in, born in, and have served North Carolina all of my life.
You know, I know some people who like live in Asheville, for instance. Asheville, very progressive, wonderful area, right? But because of gerrymandering, it's represented by, you know, people like Mark Meadows and the worst of the worst. What is it? And again, the districts are going to be redrawn based on this census that Trump screwed up horribly, like he did everything else. And what do you have any solution for that? I mean, what do we do about that?
Well, I certainly have sponsored legislation for a nonpartisan redistricting commission. I think that that is the solution, and it's my understanding that several colleagues are refiling that bill and working toward that. We brought together 15 grassroots organizations to advance that policy before. But prior to the redistricting that's created by the census, we also, it was the last court ruling from the court, initially the districts in North Carolina were racial gerrymanders. Yeah. And then the last, 2 years ago, the courts determined that it was partisan gerrymandering. And that is why we have a Republican-controlled North Carolina House and North Carolina Senate, because of this unconstitutional gerrymandering. Right. And so we anticipate moving forward, the majority has been put on notice that they cannot continue to deny the citizens of North Carolina their constitutional right of one person, one vote. And so we are following that and tracking that very carefully to ensure that there are no racial gerrymanders, that there are no partisan gerrymanders. And finally, the people of North Carolina, the 10 million people that are here, that we can have our constitutional right to one person, one vote.
That's what we need. Howie?
Yeah. When I think about the rural districts of North Carolina, and I see them electing people like Cawthorn.
Just horrible.
And like Virginia Fox and like Patrick McHenry. I mean, it just scares me when I think about people like those. Being not how bad they are, that's a separate thing, but how people can look at a ballot and say, yes, I want Madison Cawthorn to represent me in Congress.
Right.
Or I want Virginia Fox to represent me in Congress.
Or Lauren Boebert or Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, some of the characters that are
Georgia.
Coming out. I know, but I'm just saying it's all over. But yes, Georgia especially. Right. I mean, North Carolina. I get what you're saying. Sorry. I shouldn't interrupt.
So, I mean, because Erica's going to have to campaign among those people.
Right.
She's going to have to ask those people for their votes. I mean, can you go to the people in Virginia Fox's district and say, hey, I'm offering you broadband for all and Medicare for all and free education for your children and your grandchildren? Are they going to listen to your message?
Well, absolutely. And so this goes back to what we shared. The rising new American majority, they want more. They want their fair shot. That's what Georgia was about. Because recall that Warnock and Ossoff were campaigning off of $2,000 stimulus checks.
Right.
That's what they were campaigning on. So this is a platform, yes, it's bold, but it's big enough and it's bold enough to truly address the real problems that real working families are facing all across this state. And so that's why people have been disenfranchised. And I want to go back and reemphasize the Stacey Abrams playbook. We have been the campaign who last time were the ones who got out to the red counties, the ones in the western end of the state, those rural counties where we haven't had a lot of Democrats to win those races. But we have good, faithful, loyal voters there. We just have to seek them out. We have to register them. We have to get them to the polls. Yeah. We have to get them positioned and educated on the issues to vote.
Without a doubt. We're coming up on the end of the hour, so I want to make sure everybody knows her name is Erica Smith. Erica for us. com. I know it could be U.S., but I think it's for us. Because you know.
It's for us. One of us for all of us.
Absolutely. Howie, any closing words?
Hey, donate to Erica's campaign. You can do that either by going directly to Erica's website, or you can go to Blue America and do it there. But and hey, that Nicole's going to post a place where you can go and donate to
yes.
Erica's site.
I will make sure it's on the blog post with the show, the podcast, and all the information from today. So if you're interested, hopefully you want to help Erica. I wish you the best. We got, you know, I'm glad you're jumping in early because this is going to be a yes. long campaign season. But everything is at stake here. Thank you for jumping in. Thank you for running.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It was great meeting you. Howie, I'll see you next week.
Yep, and talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye. And for everyone still here, here's What's News.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
How do you spell relief?
The House on Wednesday passed the nearly $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, the American Rescue Plan, as adjusted by the Senate, sending it to President Biden for his signature, which will come on Friday.
Happened
House
today.
Democrats pushed through the legislation in a 220 to 211 vote without any Republican support. The package includes a lot of relief for Americans who've been struggling. Another round of stimulus checks, extended extra unemployment benefits. It also sends billions of dollars to city, state, and tribal governments and small businesses that have struggled to stay afloat during the pandemic. There are also provisions such as expanded tax credits and food aid that could cut child poverty in half. Republicans argued that the plan was too expensive, but a Pew Research Center poll released Wednesday found that 70% of Americans support it. So the president will sign the bill Friday afternoon, then embark on a tour across the country promoting the package and explaining to Americans just what's in it. And there's a lot there. Before the bill is even signed, it's already having an effect. American Airlines had notified 13,000 of its employees that they were going to be furloughed effective April 1st. Well, on Wednesday, they told those same employees to tear up those notices, crediting the passage of the ARP, the American Relief Plan, for saving those jobs. Again, this would be a good time to remind you that not one single Republican in either the House or Senate voted in favor of this relief bill. The Senate on Wednesday confirmed Merrick Garland, a federal appeals court judge, to be attorney general. The vote was 70-30. It came nearly 5 years after then-President Obama nominated Garland to fill the Supreme Court seat vacated when Antonin Scalia died. Republicans controlled the Senate at the time, and they refused to even consider the nomination, keeping the seat open for almost a year until Obama was out of office and his successor, the former guy, took over. This time, Garland was confirmed with support from 20 Republicans, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and others who were instrumental in keeping him off the Supreme Court. Typical. The Senate also voted Wednesday to confirm Congresswoman Marsha Fudge of Ohio to be President Biden's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. That vote was 66 to 34. It made Fudge the first black woman to run HUD in more than 40 years. Under the previous administration, the HUD Secretary Ben Carson sharply cut back fair housing enforcement. Fudge had said during her January confirmation hearing that she would push to end discriminatory housing practices under Biden's push for racial justice and increased black homeownership. Lordy, there are tapes, and a new one has just emerged, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. Yes, then-President Donald Trump pressed Francis Watson, the chief investigator in the Georgia Secretary of State's office, back in December to look for fraud in mail-in ballots that were under audit. The call was first reported by the Washington Post back in January, but the recording was released Wednesday by the Wall Street Journal. Trump told Watson, quote, "something bad happened," and added, when the right answer comes out, you'll be praised. Ugh. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis is conducting a criminal investigation into alleged pressure on Georgia officials to overturn President Biden's 12,000-vote victory in the state. President Biden announced Wednesday that his administration was ordering another 100 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's single-shot coronavirus vaccine. The urgency of the vaccine push reflects concerns that highly contagious new variants could disrupt manufacturing and trigger another surge of the virus. The new order will bring the federal government's total order for Johnson & Johnson's vaccine to 200 million doses. The government also has ordered 600 million doses of the two-dose vaccines made by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. Biden said his goal is to make sure the U.S. has enough of it and then share some with other countries. Jury selection is underway in the murder trial of former Minnesota cop Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. Yes, murder. He's currently charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. A third-degree murder charge had been dropped, but an appeals court overturned that. On Wednesday, the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected Chauvin's appeal, and on Thursday morning, the judge in the case reinstated that third-degree murder charge as well. Three other former officers charged with aiding and abetting are scheduled to go to trial in August. But there's more. President Biden on Wednesday also restarted the Central American Minors Program to help children fleeing violence in Central America. Now the administration faces a surge of migrants trying to cross the U.S. southern border. Between 2014 and 2017, the Central American Minors Program let children hoping to escape the violence in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras apply from their home countries for a chance to enter the U.S. The program applied to those under age 21 who had parents lawfully living in the United States. Well, the previous guy halted that program in 2017. President Biden's reinstatement of the program is part of a push the administration says will create a more humane situation at the border. Of course, Republicans accuse Biden of encouraging migrants to make dangerous attempts to get into the U.S. And finally, what a difference competency makes. Fewer than expected Americans filed new claims for unemployment benefits last week as an improving public health environment allows more segments of the economy to reopen, putting the labor market recovery back on track. Initial claims for state unemployment benefits totaled a seasonally adjusted 712,000 for the week ending March 6th, compared to 754,000 in the prior week. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast 725,000 applications in the last week. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.